David Corton chairs the board of the Positive Futures Network, which publishes Yes Magazine, a journal for positive futures. He's also president of the People's Centered Development Forum. He's written a few books. One of them is titled The Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism. Another one that just was revised and reprinted, an international bestseller, When Corporations Rule the World. He has 30 years as a development worker in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. He has served as a Harvard Business School professor, as well as a captain in the United States Air Force, a Ford Foundation project specialist, and a regional advisor to the U.S. Agency for International Development. And he holds an MBA and a PhD from just over the hill at Stanford Business School. Please help me in welcoming David Corton.
Well, it's interesting. You got my conservative credentials there, and I was you're probably a little worried about what's this guy going to say here after Kevin Danaher. Actually, as I was listening to Kevin, I thought, he sounds a little conservative to me. I think he's just talking about kind of taming those corporations. I've decided we need to get rid of them altogether. We're going to have real living economies, then we got to get serious about this. Anyhow, it's a wonderful thing to be in Santa Cruz. Actually, when I was living in Asia, my wife and I used to come to Santa Cruz every summer as part of our home leave. So I feel right at home here. And as I see their energy in this room, I think, gee, what if the rest of America were like Santa Cruz? What could we do then, huh? And I am so delighted to be part of this benefit. There is certainly no question in this particular age, independent media is absolutely essential. Independent media of all kind, and Free Radio Santa Cruz is an incredible institution. The thing that's most striking is, as Kevin was talking, actually, we did embarrassingly little coordination on these presentations. And yet, Kevin's underlying theme is identical to my own, which is that the task ahead of us is to transform societies dedicated to the love of money into societies dedicated to a love of life. Now that's not a small undertaking. We're in a process of awakening to the reality of our situation in the world and to the absolute imperative for deep change if there is to be any human future. We've been living in something of a dream world. September 11 was an incredible wake-up call. Just imagine. We spend billions on our military to control the world. Now, September 11, what was it, 19 guys with about $20 worth of box cutters and a few thousand dollars in flying lessons turned our everyday technology into weapons of mass destruction. Not only did they destroy two buildings and kill some 6,000 people, or three buildings, but think of what has happened since in terms of the incredible disruption of our society. The billions of dollars and wasted resources, wasted time, additional military expenditures, all prompted by that particular act, essentially of our own choosing. Their agenda was to disrupt America. It was perhaps to start a war. And they did it with essentially $20, plus a willingness to die in their cause. Now, since that's acting smart, we're acting very stupid. We've essentially given over victory. But it's amazing the educational effect on the positive side, because while our leaders are running off doing probably mostly the wrong things that are very unlikely to have much beneficial consequence, and could of course lead into an escalating, spiraling violence of devastating proportions. But there is an awakening that's taking place, not only about the waste of our military expenditure that it turns out to be useless in defending ourselves, but also what the terrorists did was stripped away the walls of illusion of Fortress America to reveal that in a world of devastating inequality, unconscionable inequality and violence, no one is safe, not even the richest and most powerful among us. That we live in a deeply troubled world, and there is no way that America can wall itself off from the consequences of that. And that is a potential start of something deeply positive. But we must use this moment, and we must take our own movements to a new level in terms of the presentation of visions, of proposals, of highlighting the distinction between the world that is and the world that can be and the world to which we are going to dedicate ourselves to create. Now, in a sense, the basic agenda hasn't changed since September 11. It's simply become more visible and more stark. And I want to share with you a little outline here of what, to me, is the human agenda for the 21st century. Now, this is kind of optimistic because we don't really have 100 years to achieve it. Bring our material consumption into balance of the earth. You know, back in the early 70s, I met the Meadows while I was just joining the Harvard Business School faculty. They're the ones that wrote the Club of Rome study on the limits to growth. You know, and they were talking about the limits to growth as a future event. Well, that's no longer a future event. You know, the fact is, we're not talking about non-renewable resources like oil, but if you take essentially the life support system of the planet, the living system that regenerates our air, our soil, our water, our forests, fisheries, maintains the stability of our climate. You know, what we see irrefutably is that the human pressures on that system, the demands of our economic activities, exceed what is sustainable. And we're in fact destroying the life support system. If you're a Star Trek fan, Scotty to Captain Kirk, life support is down 30%. That's what the statistics show, that we've destroyed roughly 30% of the life support system of the planet in the last 25 years. That's not a hopeful trajectory. So if there's going to be a future for any of us, we're going to have to do some very fundamental rethinking about how we live, how we use our resources and our priorities. Now, we're also at the same time, we are confronting the consequences of the extraordinary inequality in the world. You know, running all the way from Bill Gates, I don't know what's he worth now. He runs from 60 billion to 90 billion day to day, depending on how the market's going. At the same time, we have 1.2 billion people in the world living on less than a dollar a day, something like 2.5 billion people living on less than $2 a day. Basically an absolute deprivation at the very margins of existence. And that's going to have to change. We're going to have to change our priorities so that we are placing a priority on using our available resources to assure every person in the world a decent, meaningful source of livelihood. Well, there's another fairly big agenda item. You know, at the same time that we're bringing our total consumption into balance. So, you know, we're not going to grow our way out of poverty in a world in which we're already exceeding the limits. Okay, now, if we're going to have this kind of equity and reallocation, we're going to have to democratize our institutions. Now, some of you, I don't know, I don't want to be out of line here, but some of you may have noticed that in our last election, we had a few problems with democracy in the United States. You know, it's one of these things, yeah, I think democracy would be a good idea. Why don't we try it? I was just at a conference where one of the speakers was talking about, well, we need to create a global government based on democracy, and you know, we should have a constitution and a congress and, you know, elections and all that sort of thing. And I said, well, that sounds wonderful, but why don't we try it on a smaller scale here in the United States and see how it works? Now, if we're going to change all of this, we're going to have to replace the dominant culture of materialism with cultures grounded in life-affirming values of cooperation, caring, compassion, and community. Can't have societies dedicated to love of life if we're all focused on money and materialism. And then the bottom line down here. Integrate the material and spiritual aspects of our being to become whole persons. You know, in the social movements, we don't much talk about spirituality. But I've come increasingly to realize that without getting into contact with the spiritual ground of all existence that unifies all of life, it's really not realistic to expect that we're going to make these kinds of changes. That they must come out of a spiritual and planetary awareness. You know, actually, I want to suggest that everyone take note of that response on that particular issue, because it's very striking to me that in most of our progressive gatherings, we never mention spirituality, and yet it is very clear from my experience that virtually every leader in our movements has a sense of spiritual grounding and acts out of a sense of spiritual grounding. And so maybe it's time we talk about it a little bit. Okay, it's a big agenda we're talking about. It's not going to come about easily. It's going to come out of some kind of a new awareness, new spirituality. How many of you are familiar with the name Paul Ray or the term cultural creatives?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? A few people. Well, let me fill you in. This is terribly important. I mean, when people ask me, what is my source of hope that we can, in fact, achieve changes of the radical nature I'm talking about? That source of hope for me comes out of the evidence from surveys like the work that Paul Ray is doing. He lives right up here in Marin County, as you might guess, given the nature of his work. He tells us that from survey research that roughly 50 million adult Americans strongly embrace the values of community and the environment. That they really want to see significant change in terms of our social policy and in terms of our environmental policy. He calls them cultural creatives. Now, the thing he points out is that the cultural, you really couldn't identify this group as a values cluster as little as 30, 35 years ago. That this is basically a new phenomenon. He also tells us that roughly half of these cultural creatives, which would be about 25 million adult Americans, combine that environmental and social values cluster with some kind of inner spiritual practice or sense of spiritual grounding. He calls those the core cultural creatives. He then tells us that virtually all of the leadership of the progressive social movements all across the board, the leaders are almost invariably part of that core cultural creative group. Now, part of what's significant about this, I want to take you back through what Paul tells us about where does this come from in the United States, because it carries a terribly important message about the significance. In the United States, he traces it back to the Civil Rights Movement. What he says is during the Civil Rights Movement, that was when for many of us, particularly from the white community, we came to realize for the first time that relationships among the races are defined by cultural codes that have nothing to do with reality. And that those cultural codes are self-limiting, they're self-destructive, And they are simply cultural codes, so we can put them aside once we recognize their nature, that they're not valid. And this is significant because most of us, you know, we grow up culturally within whatever our culture is, and we never question it, you know. What the messages that our culture sends becomes reality. It becomes the way that we see the world. So it's a very significant event when we begin to wake up and begin to recognize culture for what it is. It is a story that may or may not relate to reality. And that if we are to be fully free, fully mature human beings, we need to become conscious of our cultural stories and be more selective. Okay, now we had this experience with the Civil Rights Movement, and then that was followed quite soon after by the Women's Movement. I don't know if you picked up the parallel, same thing. Relations among the genders defined by a cultural code that had nothing to do with reality. Okay, so let's think about that one. New story. Then we had the same thing between straights and gays. We had the same thing in terms of the environment, how we define our relationship with the living earth. And now we're into the relationship with our economic system, our relationship to corporations. And again, we're finding the way, the degree to which our behavior, a whole way of seeing the world, is shaped by cultural constructs that are ultimately self-limiting and ultimately false. Now, the deeper significance of this is the awakening of a new cultural consciousness. Awakening to the role of culture, the role of our stories, and then we begin to see the whole range of stories that are so incredibly self-limiting, including our stories about human nature. You know, it's perpetuated by economists, but also out of the whole, you know, the whole of a now actually antiquated physics that told us that the only reality is material, that life is but an accident of material complexity, and consciousness is an illusion. And spirit, well, there's certainly nothing like spirit. I mean, this is, if it doesn't have a material body, it doesn't exist. You know, and those, you know, those cultural frames become the prisons within which we live, and which limit our very conception of the possibility that perhaps human beings could be truly loving, caring, cooperative creatures who might in fact be able to get along with one another. So I see this awakening of a cultural consciousness, which of course is also related to an awakening of a planetary consciousness, an awakening of a new spiritual consciousness, is not just a new cultural phenomenon, it is a new step in the human evolutionary process. This is the awakening of a new consciousness, a step that takes us to new species possibilities. Okay, and this is happening actually all around the world. You know, the most complete data is here in the United States, but the best estimates are that there are another 80 million cultural creatives currently in Europe, and I know from my own experience traveling around the world that the same thing is happening virtually every place in the world. Now, let's look at what happens. You probably wouldn't be here tonight unless you have participated in this awakening at some point in your life. And when we first awaken to this new sense of reality and values, we find ourselves rather divided in ourselves because we find our behavior not totally aligning with our new understanding. So we begin to make some changes. We begin to change our relationship with our spouse. You know, Kevin learns how to do the dishes. We maybe start practicing a little voluntary simplicity, do some recycling, and so forth. And then we begin to realize that our families, maybe our coworkers or some of our neighbors start to look at us a little strangely. What are you doing? Are you from some other planet? And we begin to feel a little uneasy, you know, maybe I'm a little crazy. I mean, I don't fit in. So then we begin to reach out, and at that moment, we tend to feel very isolated and very disempowered. And of course, part of this is that we don't see these new values, or the new me, reflected in the media. We're certainly not represented in any way in the political system. So we feel isolated, we feel disempowered. Until we begin to find some new friends who share our values and who are engaged in trying to do some reorientation of their own lives in similar ways. And then we begin to form communities of congruence. And then as we begin to form these communities of congruence, some kind of a book club or a potluck dinner club or maybe come out to some gatherings like this and find new friends, these communities of congruence begin to find one another. We start reaching out in terms of alliances, and then we start creating some new cultural spaces. Maybe some of us get together and form a buying cooperative or something of the sort, or we start to get some new discussions in our church organizations or whatever. But we begin to build the webs of relationships, building alliances, which ultimately become the foundation of a new politics. And this is very much the stage that we're in, that most of the 50 million public cultural creatives in the United States are still feeling rather isolated. And many still don't kind of recognize that they're part of a larger phenomenon. This I tell you, is basically what Yes Magazine is about. This is our underlying premise, that we need a publication that helps cultural creatives recognize themselves, recognize they're not crazy, make connections, and find that there are lots of people engaged in positive actions toward creating a new future, and you can become part of that, and so forth. And then that begins to break the isolation and the disempowerment. So this is the kind of process that we are going through, and it suggests it has very important implications for our politics, because it is helping one another move through this process that is the key to building a new kind of political power. You know, we're not talking about creating a world that grows out of some book by some intellectual like Kevin or myself, you know, or is defined by some political elite. We're talking about a political vision that grows out of the experience, the aspirations, and the values of growing millions of people all around the world. And part of the privilege in my life of having lived in Africa, Central America, Asia, lots of travel in Europe and other parts of the world, is to recognize the extent that behind all our wonderful, rich cultural differences, there is a shared underlying set of values that are essentially cooperative, loving, caring values. And there is underlying a very similar vision of the world that could be. If you ever get a chance to check out the Earth Charter on the web, this is a document that grew ultimately out of the Rio conference in 1992 on environment and development, but it was not an official document. It evolved over years from the inputs of thousands and thousands of people all over the world. Yeah. And it's about this new vision. Now, that's a whole new thing. You know, we've never had a politics so grounded in real people truly from the bottom up. And it's a politics of the whole, centered on the affirmation of life and the affirmation of democracy, the idea that every person should have a say in the decisions that affect their lives, and a belief that society, that economics, should be life-serving. Now, in movements of the past, we have generally had charismatic leaders, people who come to the fore around which we can all rally. Some among us are very frustrated because we look around and don't see any charismatic leaders. Who do we rally behind? Well, that's not the nature of this movement. This is a movement of millions of leaders. I love the phrase, "We are the ones we have been waiting for." Yeah, and that's very important to embrace, to recognize that if there's going to be a future, every one of us has to be a leader. We can't wait for one another. Act. The old politics centered on violence to gain control over the institutions of power. Now, we're going to take over the state. We're going to take over the corporations. Again, this is a new politics grounded in nonviolence, But it is also not about capturing the instruments of power. It is about transforming the relationships and the institutions of power, transforming them fundamentally to democratize them, to turn hierarchy into networks of cooperative partnership relationships. And this, of course, is one of the very strong messages of those who were engaged in the demonstrations, as in Seattle. You know, the formation of affinity groups, the practice of consensus decision-making, even under the most extreme conditions of police violence. This is about living the new, learning new ways of relating and decision-making that align with the future we're trying to create. And the whole effort, the whole movement, is grounded in awakening of spiritual and environmental consciousness. It's a very profound historical moment because we're right in the midst of what we must create as a transition between an era of empire that goes back thousands of years to create a new human era of community. And this distinction, you know, the era of empire was about a few people gaining control over the lives and resources of many people to impose order and, of course, to capture the resources of the many to create affluent lifestyles for the few. We had the traditional empires, we had colonialism, and now we have corporate globalization. It's all part of the same basic phenomenon. And the kind of future we're talking about, the society dedicated to the love of life, is about moving from empire to community. Now, in the current manifestation, it is a contest or a conflict between what I find it very useful to call the suicide economy, because it's such a descriptive term. You know, I mean, some of us know it as the global capitalist economy or the global corporate economy, but you know, then we get into all kinds of political arguments and political baggage. What is capitalism? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? But suicide economy kind of, you know, kind of sums it up pretty nicely. And we don't have to argue on those other things. Is that a good thing? Well, you know, it's destroying the foundations of its own existence as well as the existence of the human species. Gosh, I think maybe that's a problem. You know, what we need to create, we need to replace this, you know, not just sort of pretty it up around the edges, but we need to get rid of the culture and the institutions of the suicide economy and replace them with the culture and institutions of living economies that mimic the patterns of healthy living systems, which under, by the understanding of the new biology, are fundamentally cooperative in their nature and relationships. So we're moving from a defining cultural value of money to a defining cultural value of life, from organizing principles centered on competition and domination to organizing principles of cooperation and partnership. And we must be clear that the institutions and the culture on this side are fundamentally at odds with the culture and institutions of the living economy. There is no place within a living economy for institutions that are that command economies larger than most states, that are fundamentally authoritarian in their character, and that are dedicated to making money for the richest people in society to the disregard of all life values. Once you get into it, it's not rocket science. Well, okay, where do we stand in this? That's, you know, we've got a pretty big agenda here. Is this all just pie in the sky, or are we beginning to get a little energy? Well, this struggle is really the struggle defined by the contest between corporate globalization and global civil society. You've got the forces on the one side of the institutions and values of the suicide economy trying to further rewrite the rules to speed up the suicide process, if that isn't an act of collective insanity. And then on the other side, we have civil society. These are the people who've wakened up to the fact that the cultural constructs driving the suicide economy are flawed, that they're taking us where no sane person would want to go. Now, the manifestation, of course, is predominant in terms of resistance. But to really understand the movements, you have to look behind. What was it that really brought all the people together in Seattle and in Prague and in Quebec City and Barcelona and Genoa and so forth? And there's fundamentally two things. One is a deep commitment to democracy, and the other is a deep commitment to life values. And Vandana Shiva tells us that in India they call it the living democracy movement. You know, it's got a certain ring that anti-globalization movement doesn't quite have. It's also a whole lot more accurate because none of us are against global cooperation. We're none of us against global exchange. None of us are against trade. It's just we want a different framework that is life-serving and democratic. So, okay, we're the living democracy movement. Over on this side, we have the existing capitalist society. Money is the background, the ground that defines the flow of values and the flow of power. Coming down through the financial markets, which are actually the governing system of the planet, where this $2 trillion a day is exchanged through the world's currency exchanges looking for short-term profits. The movements in those financial markets hold governments captive because if the politicians in a country do not advance policies that are considered business-friendly by the speculators, they raid the currency and financial liquidity dries up, the economy collapses, and the government's thrown out. I mean, this is a real form of extortion. Those same financial markets actually make it virtually impossible for the largest corporations to do anything other than to rape the earth and society for short-term profits, because if they don't, they're bought out or the CEO's fired and so forth by the dynamics of the financial market. So the whole driving ethic, the whole priority of the society becomes mobilized around making money. And one way of looking at it is that the whole system is quite literally destroying life, the life of the planet, the life of community, the lives of people, and so forth, to make money for the very rich. Great system. Now, between the dynamics of the financial market and the outright buying of politicians, that system controls our politicians, destroys democracy, and makes government work simply as an extension of the corporate agenda. Through the mass media, the corporate media, we see the manipulation, the fabrication of our culture to maintain the worldview, the culture, the values that support the economic sphere, that support the interests of money, in part by keeping us as individuals alienated from our spiritual nature and keeping us focused on searching for identity and meaning in corporate logos and materialistic products, red convertibles, and so forth. That again, if we step back in a little reflection, it's pretty clear none of those are going to give us any real meaning or satisfaction. Now, one of the things I want to emphasize here is that the real foundation of this edifice rests on the culture, rests on the ability to manipulate and fabricate a culture and to keep us sleeping as if in a trance to the reality that fabricated culture hides. Which again is why the cultural awakening is so important and why a fundamental aspect of our political agenda must be a cultural agenda, a cultural strategy. Now, the alternative over here in terms of, actually still playing around the names, but I sometimes call the alternative the civil society. You know, we call ourselves civil society, but it's like a segment of people. But actually, our goal is to create a truly civil society. That is the larger issue. It's a type of society. It's not just a group of people. And in our actions, we are trying to create islands of civility, in a sense, that reflect the values of a civil society, grounded in a sense of connection to spirit, a recognition of our embeddedness in nature. A society in which our cultures flow out of the aspirations and values of ordinary people through the discourse of our exchange in our communities, in our engagement in cultural and arts activities, in education and expression and so forth, which is the way cultures are traditionally generated and regenerated. Then out of these living cultures authentic cultures. We create our democratic institutions of the polity. We create living economies that are grow out of our needs, not out of our greed, and that are designed to serve life. Now, this sort of sets up the distinction between the suicide economy, comprised of predatory enterprises, and living economies, comprised of living enterprises. Now, it's very interesting to me. Often people say, well, why are you got such a thing up your butt about corporations? they're just groups of people, just like all the rest of us. Well, in fact, they're not just groups of people. If you really look at there are sets of legally enforced rules and structures. And if you look at a corporation, it's best understood as a pool of money, not a community of people. Because every person in a corporation is expendable, including the CEO. They can all be fired at any time if they are not adequately serving money. And the law, the law assures that. Now, if you embezzle the money, or you're engaged in the misuse of the money, then you're subject to all sorts of legal sanctions because we're protecting the money, not the people. That's also pretty good, isn't it, huh? You kind of wonder what genius designed this. Now, those pools of money are governed by absentee owners and unaccountable managers for the purpose of cultivating material desire and converting the living capital of subject peoples and places to money for the short-term financial gains to shareholders and managers. Wow, don't you love it? Living enterprises are communities of people. This is what we need to create. Enterprises that function as communities of people governed by local stakeholders, workers, customers, people living in the community that have a real engagement with the enterprise, with accountable managers that are devoted to meeting needs and investing in building the living social and natural capital of inclusive place-based communities for the long-term well-being of people, community, and nature. Can we get into that? Okay. Now, fortunately, as Kevin gave us quite an inventory of positive initiatives taking place. Of course, even give a little credit to some of the big predatory corporations where I think he's kind of selling out a little bit by my reckoning, but which is not characteristic of Kevin. But one of the breakthroughs that I see happening in terms of our thinking is getting a greater clarity on the distinction between suicide economy and living economies and the nature of the institutions that are appropriate to both. And then what we see here is that we actually have many, many, many of the elements of living economies already in place. And I'll just throw this list up. We don't need to go through all of them. I think you recognize them immediately. Community-oriented independent businesses like your local independent bookstores right here in Santa Cruz, your coffee shops. We have Echo Villages. Yeah, let's hear it for the independent bookstores. The ones that are actually going to survive Amazon.com. Anyhow, holistic healthcare, land trusts, Echo Builders, recycling programs, community banks, local currencies. All of these different positive initiatives which are grounded in the values of the living economy. Now, here's the major point I want to leave you with. Most of these initiatives survive at the fringes of the suicide economy, in many ways dependent on the suicide economy. Within a game where all the rules are geared against them. Now, I know, is Greg here with us tonight? I
think. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We're going to hear from Greg Steffenpool from the Social Ventures Network tonight. Social Ventures Network is one of the most amazing business groups I've ever come across. I've become very cynical about socially responsible business groups because most of them are feel-good organizations concerned about trying to create a little green image around themselves. Social Ventures Network is not like that at all. Social Ventures Network is a bunch of people with real fire in the belly commitment to the idea that business can be like, can and should be and must be life-serving, and that profit is a means, not the ends of the enterprise. And Greg will tell you a little bit about what's happening in the Social Ventures Network, but this idea grows out of meetings with this group. That the key to change, the key to economic transformation, is to recognize that we already have an incredible number of these building blocks already in place. And that what we must begin to do is to begin to encourage these initiatives, those of us who are involved in them, to gradually walk away from the suicide economy. One of my friends calls it walking away from the king. You know, okay, we're not gonna fight you, king. You know you got your game there. But we're not gonna play your game anymore. We're gonna go create our own game. And of course, you think about that, if everybody walks away from the king has no power. You know, there's a fundamental lesson here. This whole system of the suicide economy exists fundamentally on the energy that we give over to it, the life energy that we yield to it. Okay, we withdraw that life energy, we walk away, we take our initiatives and our resources with us, and we begin to knit these initiatives together so that they're not just individual initiatives, individual life-serving enterprises, but we begin to weave the relationships of a new economy, a new living economy. And as we begin to weave those relationships into place, we create more opportunities for all of us and for all of our fellow beings whenever we're making a decision about where to shop, about where to work, or about where to invest. It becomes clearer and clearer that we have a choice between the suicide economy and the living economy with fundamentally different implications for the whole of the human future. This is a very difficult moment in history, and I, for the younger people, I have this outpouring of concern and sympathy for the, for the really appropriately grounded fear that many of you must sense about what will your future hold. On the other hand, I also see you are perhaps the most privileged generation in history, because this is the most exciting, the most defining moment in the whole of the history of our species. It is the moment at which we must wake up and recognize that we can, that we must choose our future. We can shape our future by conscious choice. We can take responsibility for our presence on this incredible living planet, find our place of service to the whole, and to create societies with possibilities far beyond anything any of us in this room can presently imagine.